Welcome to another PI World podcast. This is an audio-only version offered as another way to enjoy our great content. A full video version can be seen on piworld.co.uk, where you can find many more videos of interest to investors.
Okay, good afternoon, everybody. I always feel that we should ask Mela to run the railways because everything seems to work perfectly. Can I ask for a quick show of hands, how many people have actually heard me speak at a Mela event before? Okay, slightly over half the room, slow. For the other half, I will go back to the basics of who we are and what we do. So apologies for those of you who have heard me before. The context for the talk today is that Impax Asset Management, which is an AIM-quoted company, is going to be producing its interim results on the 5th of June. We've announced that. And so I'm sort of slightly to a rock and a hard place in terms of what I can tell you. But if you'll forgive me for not being able to share the interim results with you, I will give you some context as to what has been happening in our first half. And that should lead to an indication of where the results might be coming out. So asset management is quite a simple model. So without further ado, I started this business in 1998. Prior to that, I'd spent 10 years, first part of my career, really just becoming fascinated by the interface between environmental problems and capitalism, and trying to work out as a youngster what it would take to mobilise private capital to address some of the environmental problems that were going on in the world. So 20 years on from the start of Impax Asset Management, and really sort of 30 years on since the start of my career, which of course is a large number for us all to admit when we get to a certain age, what we've been able to do as a team is build, I think, the world's leading brand, which is helping sophisticated investors around the world to make money from backing the businesses that are solving problems around the world in the environment, but also helping to improve efficiency of resources, which for everyone who knows about economics is kind of what economics is all about. So although we may have started off with somewhat of a vocational mindset, today we are very much in the crosshairs of red-blooded capitalism, while at the same time doing a job which is making a positive contribution to the environment. And I'm sure, as you can appreciate, that in today's climate, to be able to claim money-making but also doing good is quite a powerful message. So the way we describe our investment philosophy is that we're specialists in the transition to a more sustainable global economy. Now, those words are all chosen quite carefully. There's no ESG in there. There's no social responsibility. There is no definitive point in which the world might become sustainable. It may never become sustainable. So the word more suggests that as world population grows from 7.6 billion or so today to some larger number, and there's big debate about whether it's going to be 9 billion by the middle of the decade, middle of the century, or 9 billion by the end of the century, there's going to be a lot more people on the planet. They'll be crowding into cities. They'll be demanding higher and higher levels of wealth and comfort, and that will put more pressure on resources, be it natural resources such as minerals, environmental resources like air quality, or just simply congestion. In addition, there will be problems related to lifestyle type diseases, and there will also be opportunities around digitalization. So a lot of sort of drivers in the economy, which you know very well, we have decided to bundle them together in this concept of the transition to a more sustainable global economy. What do I mean by investment philosophy? Well, for those of you who've been in the investment management industry, that's right at the centre of what defines an investment firm. If you go out into the world of pension funds and private banks and you try and say something which is different to what the 999 other asset managers have been saying in recent times to the same people, bearing in mind there's 1,000 or several thousand investment managers, you need to say something which is distinctive. And we're finding that this concept is differentiated, particularly when we say that we've been working in this area for 20 years. And although BlackRock and Vanguard and Schroders and others may be using similar language, they've only been using that language in recent times, and therefore their authenticity, which is a key word that underpins the Impax brand, is judged to be weak. And time and again, we are shortlisted for big mandates, and quite frequently we are winning from the shortlist. So as a firm, we have built this business up. I'll show you the trajectory of 20 years of growth in a moment. But today we are actually £13.7 billion under management. That's the assets under management number we announced at the end of April. For those of you that are interested in following us and don't know this already, at the end of every month, actually, it's more like the, I think it's the sixth business day for the new month, we post the AUM number at the end of the previous month. And so that gives you a sort of monthly ticker as to how well we're progressing at a very crude level. That compares to £12.5 billion at the end of September, which is our year end. So material growth in the first half, and that's against the backdrop when markets were actually pretty terrible in the first period of our first half, i.e. October through December. So in spite of a really significant headwind for half of our first half, we have had positive flows in each quarter, and we'll be reporting the March number, which was 13.1 or 2, I think that was already in the market, and then also reminding people of this 13.7 billion number. So here's a hint as to how the first half is going to look. It's going to be quite a nice story based on quite considerable growth. What does this donut show? Well, it shows that in the big big ring that we call thematic equities, those are the environmental funds that we run, for example, Impax Environmental Markets PLC, which is our investment trust. It's about £500 million. It's the UK's largest environmental closed-end fund. It's been up and running since 2002. That's part of the environmental fund range that we today call thematic equities. We also have a private equity business, which we label as real assets. And in the light blue, you can see the business that we bought in New Hampshire in January 2018, a company called Pax World Management, which I'll come back to and explain that in a bit more detail. But the integration of that business is going very well. And essentially what they do is US-oriented generic equities, fixed income, and also some smart beta. So 20 years of history. I'm sure everyone's got their own little graphic that summarizes their life in 20 years. This is what I've been doing since 1998. So you can see here, this is assets under management to the end of September each year. We had a pretty long runway to get off the ground, and we were only profitable in 2005 when we had a big leap forward in relative terms, up to just over £200 million. We had a pretty good financial crisis. So in the 6 months between the end of September 2008 and the end of March 2009, the sort of depth of the financial crisis, we only lost 4% of our clients. In other words, money going out of the door. Net asset values, of course, dropped further, but then they came roaring back again as the market recovered. So we had a financial crisis back here. You remember the collapse of the tech space in 01, 02. We had another one much more serious here. And there'd been a few bumps in the road, but we've had pretty respectable growth. And then the last 3 or 4 years, we have accelerated, in particular because I think our performance numbers have continued to improve. Our distribution architecture has continued to expand. And in this number, 2018, we included the Pax business, which I think was about £3.5 billion of that £12.5 billion. So is asset management dead? I think if you read the papers these days, it's hard to, financial papers anyway, it's hard to avoid some sort of commentary on the rise of passive funds and the fact that active managers are really struggling to sustain their fees. Having said that, at a time when we've had arguably 10 plus years of equity markets marching upwards, valuations are pretty full, and there are many sophisticated investors around the world who think the party can't carry on as it has been doing, and are increasingly looking for differentiated investment management ideas. And so in the world in which arguably there is a bifurcation or a split of the industry into, on the one hand, those mega brands like Vanguard and BlackRock, who are all seeking, not in their case, but the others are seeking to get to $1 trillion under management, offering a wide range of products and strategies to just about everybody. That's one block which is emerging and challenging the middle market or mid-ground, if you like, alongside a new group, which is the boutiques. And the boutiques who've got something which is different that can offer a service to complement a passive fund and are playing quite nicely in the world in which the constant rise of equity markets can't be guaranteed to go on forever, then Impax plays very well. So in that context, we are not trying to become like BlackRock ever, nor are we trying to map out our product range so that we've got something for everybody. We believe that our investment philosophy is differentiated. It is leading to more and more opportunities as the years march on, given the inexorable pressure that the trends around sustainable development are bringing. And in that context, by having a business that's been around for 20 years, a very stable team that owns 30% of the company, and a set of products that have by and large got long, quite compelling track records, and a distribution architecture which is essentially global in all the key markets where there's money to be raised, then we've got a bright future. This is not the only way of being a differentiated boutique. There's many others out there, but we do feel as though we are working on a very sort of robust platform. The other key things which I'd like to point out at this stage which differentiate Impax compared to some of our UK listed peers are that we have not much more than, or slightly more than, rather than 90% of our clients outside the UK. So our exposure to UK wealth in terms of funds coming in for us to manage is less than 10%. And the assets that we manage are more than 95% invested outside the UK. So there's nothing wrong with pitching to UK individuals or UK institutions to manage money. There's nothing wrong with investing in the UK. But if you're looking for something which is in the asset management space, which is complementary to some of our peers who do one or both of those things, then we do sit quite nicely. So just to go into our investment thesis in a little bit more detail, I think it's fair to say that solving environmental problems is something that socially responsible or values-driven investors would like to do. So many families around the world, many religious organisations, some sovereign wealth funds in certain parts of continental Europe. There is a hunger, if you like, for exposure to environmental impact. Having said that, our experience over a long period of time is that there's much bigger demand for investment ideas which are mainstream and are linked to long-term drivers. And so if you look, for example, at the power sector in Europe, then more than 85% of the money going into power equipment and power businesses in Europe today is in wind, solar, hydro, or other renewable energy. So as you'll have seen recently, General Electric is in difficulty in part because of its gas turbine business. Siemens is trying to divest its gas turbine business. In spite of shale gas being plentiful around the world, the demand for gas-fired generation has crashed beyond or below expectations. It's almost impossible to get mainstream finance now for certain types of coal-generating facility. And if you're in the nuclear industry, you'll know very well that the delays on the European reactors in Finland and France have been extraordinary, with budget overruns of many multiples the original budget, and time delays in the order of 5 years, if not in some cases getting on for 10 years. So clean energy today is mainstream energy. Similarly, in the transportation space, then I don't know whether many of you bought a new car recently, but you probably have. If you have done, you've gone through a pretty agonizing decision about whether you should buy a diesel car. Probably in the last 12 months, no, but 12 months prior to that, you might have been sitting on the fence. But you should buy a petrol car, actually, because will those get regulated out of existence? We all know that from October 2021, if you live within the North Circular, South Circular ring, you're going to have to pay, I think it's £12 a day just to get your diesel car out of the driveway. So at the same time, plug-in hybrids and non-plug-in hybrid vehicles are now pretty plentiful. They're sensible price points. Electric vehicles are not quite there yet, but with a bit more infrastructure and the products that are being launched over the next couple of years from all the main OEMs, there should in 2 or 3 years' time be a really plentiful supply of quite exciting electric vehicles that have got some quite good range. Having said that, it's a complex space. And so as a discerning investment manager who's not out to change the world but out to make money, then the smart thing to do in the transportation space is to look at the picks and shovels equivalents, for example, companies making tailpipe emission testing equipment or companies providing consulting services to the original equipment manufacturers. But clean transportation is mainstream transportation now, I think is my key point. In the water sector, then if you've got a technology which can provide certain type of water quality in one geography or one constituency, then by and large, because of the similarity of human physiology around the world, you have a business idea which, with a bit of tweaking, can be rolled out just about anywhere on the planet. So the scalability of investments in the water technology space is almost as good as anything I've ever seen. There's no real culture differences behind water quality, for example, as there might be with web-based businesses. In the waste space, then, historically, we've all thrown our waste into holes in the ground, but for the last 30 or 35 years or so in continental Europe, it's been increasingly expensive to do that. It's prohibitively expensive in places like Germany for 20 years. In the UK, the landfill tax has effectively made landfilling really quite an unappealing option for local authorities that are collecting large volumes of garbage. And so what we've done over the last 15 or so years is built up a pretty sophisticated materials recovery, materials sorting, materials packaging into containers and materials transshipment to China and other places, which is all very well until the Chinese suddenly realized that the stuff that was arriving on their ports was not very well sorted, was quite often dirty and sometimes contained scores of unsorted black bags. So they've banned the import of recycled material as of 18 months ago, and there is increasing pressure from other parts of the world to do the same thing. So that's producing shocks to the waste management system that are quite challenging to navigate if you're an incumbent business. But if you're a nimble investor that can move assets around and not get locked into particular types of infrastructure, then there's plenty of opportunity from these dislocations. And in the food space, then, as you may know, 40% of food is typically wasted between the field and the fork. In developing countries, that wastage is by and large upstream, if that's the right metaphor, in the way that food is grown, harvested, and shipped to the processing centres. Whereas in the developed world, then that waste is much more downstream in supermarkets, in people's homes, as we overbuy and leave too much food on our plates, as well as supermarkets that have got tens of thousands of SKUs and a lot of which they fail to sell. So in these areas are some very significant disruptions, dislocations. There is plenty of technology which is arriving from all corners of the world, which is providing efficiency solutions. There's regulators who are very keen to improve the quality of life in urban environments to reduce morbidity and mortality from from dirty air and dirty water. And there is a rising global wave of concern around climate change. So put all this together, and if you have a team like we do, which has got over 50 specialists in the technologies, regulations, corporate dynamics, business dynamics, and investor behavior around the thousands of companies that are active in this space, then you've got a recipe for quite an interesting investment management model. Now, around 20 years ago, we decided to map out this system in a bit more classification area in a bit more detail, and produced a set of descriptions which define the environmental space for investors. That classification system was picked up by FTSE Russell in 2007 and remains at the heart of the FTSE system for defining this area. From that came a set of indices which allow us to measure our returns, our benchmark our returns, and also a definition of the eligible universe of stocks. So we've got a very thoughtful, detailed investment process which can convince a sophisticated institutional investor that we have a 20-year-old process of dealing with the investments in this area. Just to give you some recent examples of wins that we were able to talk about, back in January we started a mandate with one of the big Swedish pension funds, which asked us to run our best ideas in this environmental space, and has gone public in Sweden around its partnership with Impacts, and is actually doing some research with us together with the university to try and advance some of the metrics around impact measurement. That was a mandate which I think was a couple of hundred million euros. We've started a similar size mandate with Luxembourg State Pension Plan in partnership with BNP Paribas, and we announced at the end of 2017 a partnership with CalSTRS, the huge California state teachers' plan that they wanted to hire Impax to run some money. That is in the final stage of documentation, hasn't been yet included in our assets under management numbers, but I was out in California a couple of weeks ago and we're expecting to start that quite soon. So this is the type of institutional investor that that is hiring us, having done a global search for alternatives. So just as an indication of how this sector is growing, back in 1999, we found 250 stocks that had got at least 50% of their revenue in the environmental space, as defined on the previous slide. That 250 has grown to 1,100. And if you look at more broadly defined businesses that have got between 20 and 50% of their revenue in this space, you get another 400 stocks. So the core of our business, that sort of thematics piece here, those are the five strategies that are really picking stocks from that full range. Now, 5 years ago, as you may have heard me say before, we thought actually the trends behind these sustainable development drivers are really permeating many other parts of the economy. And having done about 18 months of research, then we decided that we could launch a more generic global equities strategy, which we've called Global Opportunities. And that strategy was seeded with our own balance sheet money at the start of 2015. So it's now got a 4.5-year track record. We kept it quiet for 3 years, but last year in December, St. James's Place became the first external client for that strategy. They allowed us to take over the management of another fund run by another manager, just shy of £300 million. So, and they'd done a global search for an investment manager in this space when they came up with Impax. And we were delighted that they picked our global opportunity strategy, which really at that stage had no clients behind it. For those of you that are interested in environmental impact, delighted to tell you that we continue to work with universities and our clients to try to sort of shape up thinking in this space. And this is quite an interesting chart, which shows the kind of the non-financial benefits of investing in Impax's strategy. So if you take the amount of carbon dioxide emitted across the planet and you divide it by the amount of money that's invested across the planet, which is also equivalent to the amount of savings, total savings, which is the order of sort of $250 trillion, depending on how you count. And it's not a precise science, but you get a number here, which is, if you like, the carbon dioxide and global warming intensity of investment on a planetary basis. If we're going to stabilize the temperature of the planet, then science suggests that we need to halve that to go from here to here. And for this is normalized for $10 million. If you take the impact specialist strategy, then the environmental performance on a CO2 basis, CO2 footprint basis, is pretty extraordinary. So when we sit down with the Swedish pension fund, for example, that's a number which really grabs them. A, because it's very impressive, and B, in absolute terms, and B, because they've not seen this sort of analysis before. Incidentally, just at risk of overstating the point, we're not setting out to produce a number like this. We're setting out to produce benchmark-beating financial returns, and by benchmark, I do mean the generic all-country world index or something like that, as well as the environmental index as well. So our distribution continues to expand. We have historically had sales team just in the UK, but since 2011, we've also had a small sales team, which has now become 10 people in two offices in the US, Portland, Oregon, and New York, covering the institutional business. And back in 2008, we teamed up with Paxwell Management, which is in Portsmouth, New Hampshire, as a partner in the mutual fund space. And Pax had and still has a mutual fund platform, licenses to sell those mutual funds to retail investors and retail investors advisors, broker dealers, wirehouses, etc., all around the United States. Great partnership. We built a business around a fund going from $1 million to $700 million in 10 years. And in that decade, we really got to know the team from Joe Keefe, the president, all the way to more junior staff. And when that business came up for sale at the end of 2016, start of 2017, then we were a natural counterparty for them to talk to. So to cut a long story short, we've ended up buying the Pax business. That was a transaction that was announced in September 2017 and closed January last year, January 2018, paid $52.5 million for it. So that was the valuation of the business. And what it gives us is access to a lot of additional product, US fixed income, US smart beta, and some really interesting actively managed US equities, all within the sustainable investing space. So that was a big transformation, if you like, or a leap forward for the business. Having said that, though, the bulk of the assets, as you saw from the donut at the start, are outside the PAX platform, and we've been particularly successful in building a partnership with a number of distribution partners, particularly BNP Paribas. So we now sub-manage five BNP Paribas funds on their Luxembourg SICAV platform. That's each of the thematic strategies. And those funds are sold in a large number of channels, mainly around continental Europe. I'm going to Hong Kong and Japan next week, and BNP Paribas in both those places are leading a roadshow where we expect to be able to extend our client base. We already have a good number of institutional and family type clients in both geographies, and the Japanese market in particular. I think given the leadership of the Government Pension Fund of Japan around stewardship and what they refer to as ESG, environmental social governance factors, then the Japanese pension fund industry is in usual fashion out there wanting to follow. And we're being showcased as the world's leader in this area. So we've got foothold in Asia, got some four mandates in Australia, and we believe that there's a lot more to go for there as well. But we're not dependent entirely on BNP Paribas. We've got very good partnership in Denmark with a group called Absalon Capital, which is a small merchant bank with some excellent institutional distribution. So Denmark is a pretty small, tight community, but with a lot of money under management. And we've got already three major accounts in Denmark. We've also got a great partnership with a Dutch bank called ASN Bank, for whom we run a fund which is about 700 million euros. We've just hired a new salesperson to market global opportunities in continental Europe alongside BNP Paribas. So we're prospecting for business out with the BNP relationship.
Is nearly everything there institutional, and how much of it is retail, or is it 100% institutional?
So the best way of thinking about it is that the PAX business is retail, and the rest of the impacts business is either directly to institutions or it's through intermediaries like BNP Paribas, who may sell to institutions or may sell to retail. But from our perspective, we just deal with BNP Paribas. So we think of going back to that donut, we think of everything in the dark blue as institutional. Now, the investor of record might be an individual family in Switzerland, but we don't deal with that family. So bearing in mind, this is the end of September last year, and therefore in financial market terms, ancient history, but we did have a phenomenally strong period, 72% growth in assets under management in the previous full financial year. We've had positive net inflows for 25 months at the end of September. We've had positive inflows in the first 6 months of financial year 2019 as well, including in the October to December period, and most fund managers saw outflows. St. James's Place stamping the quality mark on global opportunities is very important, because that strategy does have capacity of probably £20 billion. And so it'll take us some time to get there, but that does give us a very strong opportunity to grow something alongside the thematic funds. And PAX obviously is a big big leap forward. The financial highlights, I don't think it's worth dwelling on something which is already out of date, but when we report our interims at the end of, on the 5th of June, then we'll be producing an updated table a bit like that. So maybe worth just touching on our balance sheet, which is not actually mentioned there, but to purchase PAX, we used excess cash on our balance sheet. We borrowed $25 million of debt, and then we issued shares, which produced dilution of around 2%. So we were able to increase pro forma EBITDA by 43% with only 2% dilution, which was a great boost to the, or reflected with a big boost to the share price. Since the acquisition was completed in January 2018, so around 17 months ago or so, then we have repaid, the debt was in two equal tranches, a revolving fund, which we fully repaid, and the term loan, which is the other half, we've already repaid a third of that and are on track to fully repay the balance by the end of 2020. We could actually prepay early, and we've got the cash resources to do that. So our balance sheet is very much under control. In terms of dividends, then we initiated a dividend back in 2008 and an interim dividend in 2014. So you can see here the evidence of what we've stated from the outset as a progressive dividend policy. So we've stuck to that. If you look at our coverage, it is pretty conservative, and we've been signalling for 18 months or so that we do intend to come forward with a new dividend policy, which will probably be based on a target range for payout ratio. And but we've held back in announcing that because of the Pax acquisition. So I can't promise that we will come forward with that at the end of the year, but I think if you do the maths and look at the numbers, you can see there is scope for us to quite materially increase the dividends given the level of free cash. The little bar floating at the right there, 2.6, that's a special dividend which was linked to the payout of a carried interest, the carried interest component of our second private equity fund. Our use of special dividends is really one-off windfall events rather than some kind of break or accelerator on the regular payments. So we're definitely not guiding that special dividends will happen in every year. Shareholder register is it's very stable. It's quite important if you are doing analysis of earnings per share, etc., to look at the denominator correctly. So we've got 133.3 million shares, and that does include all the relevant unvested options. And so on that basis, then BNP Paribas owns just less than 25%, and employees own 30% of the business, with free float being 46%. So we think of this as a very stable triangle of interests between, if you like, management, who come to work every day and drive the investment performance, BNP Paribas, which is a significant partner responsible through the five funds for about 30% of our revenues today. And then some of you in the room, I believe, and everyone else in the free floats, who provide the marketplace, which from a management perspective is really helpful because it gives us pricing and liquidity to create new options and or buy shares and also sell shares. And so that's been the mix since BNP Paribas came in 2007, so just over 11 years of that sort of structure. Prior to that, the BNP Paribas stake was somewhat more disaggregated, and so it was a listed company, quoted company since 2001. So I think I'm coming towards the end of the slides. I'm just trying to think if there's anything which I've forgotten to tell you or I should be telling you. So if you have any questions, things that you think I should be mentioning, then do shout. Yes.
Just on the capacity, I know you mentioned 20 billion was the capacity for the opportunities.
Yeah.
On the stuff that's more highly focused on sustainability, what is the capacity of that of those funds, and how much would you put in that bucket at the moment?
Yeah, so that's a good question. So that effectively is how big could the 9 billion get to? I think it's fair to say that it's not an exact science, because it depends very much on liquidity, market conditions at the time. But if we'd done the capacity calculation at the same date this was baked, so it end of September 2018, then I think we would have been able to take another sort of 7-8 billion on top of that. So not quite doubling. So if one said that there's another, let's call it 7, and there's 20 billion in global opportunities, and then the Pax funds in theory have got almost unlimited capacity because they're in was a large US large cap strategy and US core bond strategy, which where there's unlimited liquidity within the context of these numbers, then I think what we've got, if we hadn't done the Global Opportunities Initiative and we hadn't bought Pax, we would have been faced with a business that today would have been, let's call it 9 billion with less than doubling potential. But today we've got a business which has got two other major growth drivers where the aggregate capacity is almost unlimited.
Apart from acquisitions, what do you need money for in the business to grow? Where, what sort of areas require investment to grow the business?
Well, let me answer that slightly more broadly. I should have mentioned that it's not our objective to be going out to be making more acquisitions. We think there's plenty of organic growth in just scaling this up. And the PAX opportunity was really based on the 10 years of relationship. So, but to answer your question, then the principal reason we need capital is to seed new strategies. Historically, we've put in 1 to 5 million pounds into a new strategy like the Environmental Leader Strategy in 2008 or the Asian Strategy a few years later. And we've been pretty disciplined in, actually in private equity as well, where we've put in similar amounts, but for longer term. We've been pretty disciplined in taking that money out once the track record's been established and we've been able to bring in an external client. And so we've been keeping a revolving facility of seed capital, which is of the order of sort of 8 to 12 million pounds. Now, I think there's a question we still need to work through at the board level as to how much capital we may need, whether it's a little bit more than that or substantially more than that. I think the steer at the moment is we don't need substantially more than that, which is another reason why we can increase our payout ratio, subject to being able to pay down the remaining part of the debt.
Your fund performance seems to be rather, you know, very good overall. So could you give us any insights, maybe without giving your secrets away, but how are you generating, you know, such good returns?
Well, I think in the equity funds in this space and global opportunities, then the secret is really to take a long-term perspective and to look for growth at a reasonable price. So we are constantly trawling the world, the planet, for businesses that are well positioned within high growth markets, getting to know them over a long period of time and waiting until they're cheap relative to an intrinsic value metric before we buy them. And if their share price rockets up and we can't see any value in them anymore, then just selling down or selling out. So it's not rocket science, but it's not easy unless you really understand the value drivers, for example, in technology or regulation or.
So you're really doing traditional investment analysis, but just within, you know, a smaller universe than other fund managers?
Yes, I think I described to someone last week that it's good to think of impacts in the same sort of mindset as, say, a healthcare manager or a biotech manager, where the underlying industries are pretty complicated and there's a lot of money to be lost if you get it wrong. But if you hire the right people, get them to work together in a collegial fashion and keep at it, then you can actually outperform and take a long-term perspective.
Can I ask, has the PAX World acquisition lived up to your best expectations, and have you retained all the people you wanted to retain?
Yeah, so I think three things to say. We've retained everybody that we wanted to retain. No one's left. We just had a staff survey with a 92% response rate and a 90% engagement number, which is sort of almost off the scale in terms of employee satisfaction. The integration was quite carefully pre-planned and is all going to plan. The thing that we're not completely happy with is the inflows, and the US mutual fund market had its worst quarter for a decade, if not several decades, in October through December last year, as volatility increased and sentiment collapsed. So although PAX performed better than its peer group, we've still had small net outflows. So the inflows have been neutral to slightly negative over the period since we bought it. So that's been the one thing we've been disappointed about. Having said that, the markets have been going up, so the assets haven't really dropped, but they haven't gone up as much as we wanted. Probably out of time.
Yeah.
Okay.
Thanks very much.
Thank you.
PI World videos and podcasts are for general information and interest. They do not constitute any kind of recommendation or inducement to buy shares of any company. PI World is not offering any kind of financial advice, and nothing in our material should be taken as such.